Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. We're excited to be talking today on a very interesting subject, 3D printing, which we've heard a lot about. We'll go a little bit into the history of that, but we're going to talk to two people who are actively involved in it right now because that industry is absolutely exploding, also known as additive manufacturing if you're on the committee F42, but I think it's going to take on the moniker like Kleenex. Very few people ask for a tissue, they ask for Kleenex. I think 3D printing is going to be what sticks. Before we get to that, I'd like to talk to my co-host, Lou Wise. Lou, how are you today?
Great. Thank you for asking. We have a couple of items to talk about before we kick off the show. Our postscript for last week's show was what's the deal with manufacturing? We had Brad Holcomb, chair of ISM, and we had Chris Keel, who's the economist for the FMA, and one is an analyst and the other a forecaster, which is an interesting combination. It seems as though that the ISM number came out at 48.2, which is up 0.2 from the month before. And depending upon which medium you listen to or read, 48.2 is either good or bad, whichever their preference was. We did talk to Brad about a particular point that CNN brought out in a newscast that as a result of the 48.2 and said that the manufacturing sector is in a recession. And we are in manufacturing, All Metals and Forge Group, and we don't find that the case. And I'd like to read you, because I want to make sure I get Brad Holcomb's statement correct. When we asked him about his thoughts on that, he said, quote, "This report is nonsense. We are nowhere close to that. Those kinds of headlines are ill-informed," unquote. And Brad has given me permission to use that. So pick your poison as to whether we're going up or down. That said, when the report came out on Friday about jobs, that we added another 150,000 jobs. Again, depending upon who you listen to, that was either good or bad. And this week, Chair Janet Yellen from the Federal Reserve is speaking before Congress and going to give her comments about what the year going forward might look like. And originally, they thought that they may see 4 increases during the course of this year, but being that there is some weaknesses and there are financial issues going on around the world, it may yet turn out that there will be no interest increases. So we'll just have to play it out and see how it goes. Frankly, and I usually have an opinion, I don't have one today. We'll just have to wait and see what March looks like. That'll probably give us a pretty good idea of which way the year is beginning to go. Yes?
Okay. Well, that certainly is fair game for discussion going down the road. We're going to be talking about 3D printing. You know, the future is now, from prototypes to production runs. And that's really where the industry is moving. 3D printing was very interesting in the prototype phase and what you could do with a 3D printer and what materials you could do it in. Now it's getting into a more serious phase. We're going to be talking about production runs. And we have two guests on our show today. The first I'm going to introduce is Alan Amling, who is Vice President of Global Logistics and Distribution Marketing at UPS. UPS, the big brown trucks that come to my door frequently. We love UPS, a great logistics company in the USA and around the world. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
We also have Mitch Free with us. Now, Mitch is a serial entrepreneur. He's a real manufacturing industry maverick. He's a global trade expert. Mitch started a company back in 2000 called MFG.com. It was a trading site on the Internet. It went very well. Since then, he's moved out of that particular operation. He's founded two companies. One is called Cloud DDM, and the other one, Mitch, if I get this right, is ZYCICNC Machining. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, Ziki, CNC Machining.
Ziki, okay. That's how the ZYCI is pronounced, Ziki. Mitch, how did you get started in, you know, let's turn the Wayback Machine a bit back here because you are a serial entrepreneur. What was the jump from MFG.com into 3D printing?
You know, one of the things that you know, I really enjoyed building MFG.com over about a 13-year period. You know, globally, we were facilitating lots of transactions all over the world for custom manufactured parts, and that's everything from machining, injection molding, metal fabrication, stamping, et cetera. And I was able to sort of firsthand see what global trends were happening, and then speak with OEMs and product development companies of, and hear where they felt like the puck was going, and what they were having difficulty finding. And one of the themes I kept hearing was there were a lot of companies providing 3D printing services, but they were more they called themselves service bureaus, or they were hobbyists, and they weren't set up like a manufacturing operation. You know, in a manufacturing, we need dimensional integrity, structural integrity, material traceability. And so I saw a real need to set up an additive manufacturing operation that was run like a manufacturing company that could provide scale and speed and solve real manufacturing requirements, not just prototypes.
Mitch, Lou Weiss here. And how are you after not talking to you for 25, 30 years?
It hasn't quite been that long, but
it just seems as though decades are going by, not years. How did when you started looking at 3D printing, did you see it as a production that there is production capabilities? Because everyone that we've spoken to, and we've had several shows on 3D printing, everyone's raving about it. You know, it's going to be an $8 billion industry by 2020, but they were complaining that it's not a more than a prototype venture. So what clicked in your serial entrepreneurial mind where you saw production?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where we saw the real opportunities was to add automation, right? And what I mean by that is we have systems that produce parts with very little human intervention. And if someone goes to our website at clouddm.com and they upload a file, we automatically price it. We tell them what the soonest they can get the number, that the quantity that they want. And when they decide to purchase it, it finds a printer, it starts printing, it prints, ejects the part, and the part goes off for processing and packing automatically with no human intervention. So one of the things that the reason people felt like it wasn't a production-ready tool is no one had set up a facility with any scale to it. So we have a lot of printers. We have very little labor required. And we can produce a lot of parts. We can do it fast and very economically. And I think the reason people have that perception is the capability didn't exist. There were a lot of mom-and-pop service bureaus that had one or two 3D printers, but nobody that you could go to if you needed 100 parts and you needed them tomorrow.
Now, in order to get those 100 parts tomorrow, Mitch, you have done something quite clever, and you have got a great partner you picked UPS. Alan, maybe you can share with us how you and Mitch met and how you got involved in Cloud DDM.
Absolutely. So when UPS was looking at big trends and new technology innovations, one of the ones that we had been following for a while is 3D printing. And while it, you know, 3D printing is in the manufacturing space, we really think it's going to be a supply chain disruption. And I'll take you back to the mid-90s and the impact that the Internet had on retail commerce. We see the same sort of disruption at the beginning stages that we saw back in the early to mid-90s with e-commerce in terms of 3D printing in the manufacturing space. And so as a supply chain company, we knew we had to understand more about what's going on in this space. And there were two ways to go about it. One, we could watch it and study it, or we can get in the game and be part of it. And that's really what led us to Mitch and Cloud DDM and investing in this capability and actually putting Mitch's 3D printing capability in the heart of our Worldport hub in Louisville, Kentucky. And together, as Mitch was saying, you know, the goal is to bring quality, scale, and speed to the 3D printing space. So we're, as Mitch alluded to, the 3D printers today are not printing much faster than they did last year. The way to solve the speed issue is through multiple 3D printers running at the same time. And then the advantage of being at UPS Worldport is we can take those orders and print production parts till midnight because we have a 1 o'clock pickup, and then get them anywhere in the country the next day, you know, by 9 o'clock in the morning. And so that's the vision. That's the solution that brought us together, and it's been a fun ride so far.
That is incredible. Mitch, give me an idea of what that facility looks like. I guess it's 100-something printers, and is there a conveyor belt that sits in front of them and the part ejects onto the conveyor belt? Give our listeners kind of an idea. Walk them through that facility.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you were to see the facility, you would probably think it looks akin to a computer data center almost, where there's rows of machines that are mounted in racks and printing parts, and then they eject the parts out onto an automated system, and then they go for further processing. And the reason I say they go for further processing is we have finishing options like tumbling or vapor smoothing, or maybe even screen printing on a logo. It just depends. So as they exit the printer, they then get sort of automatically routed to the next process before they go to the boxing area.
Okay.
What materials are you printing, Mitch?
Yeah, so we've got a wide array of the common materials. So ABS, polycarbonate, Ultim is quite popular. And then we also do DMLS printers, but we don't have our DMLS, our direct metal laser centering. We do stainless and titanium, but we don't have those printers at the facility in Louisville because there are some safety concerns around metal printing, and we don't want to put those in the middle of Worldport at this point.
And are those big parts or are they small parts, Mitch, for the most part? What size capacity are these?
Yeah, you know what? They're relatively small parts. I will say I'll say 80% of what we see is sort of smaller than a 5-inch cube. And I think if you look around at plastic parts, that pretty well encompasses about 80% of what you see. So So things are pretty much smaller than about a 5-inch cube is sort of the 80% rule.
Okay, Alan, I almost see somewhere down the road Cloud DDM or somebody like them printing the heart that I need for my heart transplant and UPS delivering it the next morning. What kind of applications is this being used in?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so your scenario that you just laid out, I would not rule that out, but I don't see that as the low hanging fruit right now. I think where we're seeing the most interest from our customers is around critical parts, and you know, this has always been a big part of our business. UPS has a business unit that does service parts logistics. So when you have a mission critical server or a piece of medical equipment like an X-ray machine, when that is sold, it's also sold with a guarantee that if it goes down, you'll have it fixed within 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. It varies, which means that you have to have those parts stored nearby. So today, UPS has a network of over 1,000 field stocking locations around the world that where these companies store their parts. Now, the concern is that's a lot of inventory. That's a lot of cost. And especially for out-of-production machines that these companies still have to support, they have to do what's called a last-time buy, which is they basically make a guess at how many parts they'll need around the world to service their installed base of machines. That's money, parts sitting in a warehouse that may never be used. It's a perfect application for an on-demand parts capability through 3D printing. It's not going to replace all their parts, but for those parts that they're just making a guess, it's a great alternative. And so that's one of the areas that we're looking at, and we think it's going to be a big transformation. I mean, when you look at just the overall cost of inventory in the United States, we have $1.8 trillion worth of inventory sitting in the United States. So if you can move that 0.25% or 0.5%, that's real savings to companies.
What was that number again, Alan?
There's $1.8 trillion of inventory in the United States today.
If you can move some of that to I'll print it on demand rather than have it sitting on the shelf, you have made a big difference in cash.
That's right.
Wow.
And you know, the other thing that you know Mitch talked about earlier is that you know we are beginning to move from the phase where 3D printing was all about models and prototypes, and I think prototypes are going to be a great application now and into the future, but we really see this short run, small run production runs, on-demand parts, and at some point more customized goods to be a significant driver of 3D printing. And while right now the industry is, you know, compared to manufacturing, it's not that large. But let's go back to my example of e-commerce. Everyone would agree that e-commerce has impacted retail. But the reality is it's only about 7-8% of total retail today. If you can imagine a day when 5% of manufacturing is made up of on-demand parts, prototypes, and customized goods, 5% of manufacturing is what, $640 billion. Now you're it changes your perception of what you think this industry could be.
Clearly. Now, Mitch, what kind of parts today are you seeing going into what kind of applications? I mean, I'm sorry, but my head's still stuck in, and you know, the neophyte stages. I'm printing my coffee mug with my picture on it. I don't think that's really what you folks are doing. So, what are you seeing?
Yeah, it's absolutely not. So we're printing parts for real end use applications. I mean, we're doing stuff for. I'm choosing my words carefully because a lot of our customers don't necessarily want us under, exposing themselves. But yeah, for instance, we do parts for GoPro. We do parts for Georgia Pacific. Our customers are real end use applications, and the most common use cases that we see are obviously the rapid prototype. We do that. We do it fast. We can turn around prototypes, and someone can upload parts at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and have them on their desk before 9 the next morning. So we're very good at the rapid prototypes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and we do. We're facilitating low volume production. So, low volume production. There is this no man's land between a prototype and where it makes sense to go to injection molding, even low volume injection molding. For high value products, that sometimes it's medical devices or you name it, and maybe their total addressable market or their total market for a year is 300 units, 500 units. It was very hard to make those products make any economic sense in the past because you had to go invest in injection molding and to build the tooling, and the math just didn't work. So now we're enabling a whole set of small batch, high value products that didn't make sense for us. So we're running production of small to fulfill components for small back orders of high value products. We have another set of use cases where we're doing, we refer to it as bridge to tooling. So these are people that they have committed to go build their tooling for injection molding, but they want to get in the market faster. So we're running production by additive manufacturing while their tooling is being built, and it allows them to get into the market 6 to 8 weeks faster. That's a common use case. And the other use case that we're seeing is A/B testing. So we've done this on the web for a long time. When you wanted to test a concept on a home page or some marketing material, you put up two versions. You call 1A and 1B. And then you gauge the performance of how people react and engage. And so we're seeing customers now looking at additive manufacturing as a way to do A/B testing in the physical product space. So they can try different form factors, et cetera, and see what the market prefers before they commit to investing in the tooling. So prototype, low-volume production, bridge to tooling, A/B testing, those are the common use cases that we're seeing.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, in terms of metal, direct metal, you said those were not in your cloud DDM environment. And by the way, folks, for the listeners, it's clouddm.com. We shamelessly plug our guests' websites. We want everybody to know who they are, and please go see them. But that metal environment, what makes that so unique, Mitch?
So we've got that located at our facility. So we also have a sister company that we talked about earlier, Ziki CNC Machining, which does CNC machining. Because, one, I think, additive manufacturing and subtractive manufacturing go hand in hand. A lot of times you make parts by additive, and then you have to do a small machining operation on them, especially when it comes to metals. Because metals, when you do a 3D printed metal part through this direct metal laser sintering, it comes out akin to what I would call an investment casting. It's a high precision casting that you printed. And just like any casting, you have to do machining on it. You typically will have to machine some of the interface points, maybe a face, tap some holes, things like that. And so we want our DMLS capability coupled up with machining capability in order to fulfill it. Otherwise, we would kind of be dropping the customers off short if we just sent them a 3D printed metal part in most cases. So we coupled that with our machining facility in Atlanta. And then the goal is to put that inside of the UPS Worldport locations in Louisville, and then as we expand that to the UPS locations around the globe, that we will have coexisting additive and subtractive in order to solve whatever the customer's need is very rapidly. I like to think of it as we're creating the SEAL Team 6 of part making.
Okay. Now, you said additive and subtractive. We've all heard about additive manufacturing. Define subtractive for our listeners.
Yeah, that's just a fancy term for machining. So what we're doing in machining, obviously, is we're taking a billet piece of material or a casting, and we're subtracting material from it to end up with a desired result.
And is this operation, and this is ZYCI.com for anybody who wants to visit that website. That's the one that's in Atlanta, is that right, Mitch?
That's correct. And, okay. The other reason is metal 3D printing is quite dangerous at this point. With the laser and the metal powder, and they're in a chamber, it's an argon gas-filled chamber, and there have been a lot of explosions and things. So metal 3D printing is not something for the uninitiated. It's just a lot of considerations. You have to consider that, when oxygen gets introduced, and even people have been sieving the powder and with the powder rubbing against a metal screen sometimes has sparked an explosion.
Oh, wow.
So there's no way we want to put that at this point in the UPS Worldport until that matures a little more.
Right. That would be a little too exciting. Alan, Alan, you are obviously watching the 3D space, and there's more than just plastics and metals going on there. I'm reading now where it ranges from everything to fabrics and clothing to putting icing on cookies. What's happening in the 3D space that you're seeing UPS handle in the future?
Well, beyond what we've talked about, I talked briefly about customized goods, and we're in a society more and more that's I want what I want when I want it, and don't want to have to pay too much for it, right? That's kind of where we are as consumers, and we see an opportunity for more customized goods, and so that market hasn't developed yet, but it's one of the areas that we're looking at very intently. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. We have a customer called Hopkins Golf, and Hopkins makes customized wedges and other golf clubs. And what we do for them is they literally have thousands of combinations, so they don't want to store these custom combinations. And so what we do...
Apparently we're having, and if you folks listening to the show can hear us, having some technical issues here. Our guests have dropped off, and we'll have them back online shortly here. So while we get this shaken out, which tends to happen occasionally with this kind of a broadcast that's live, making live broadcasting very exciting. We'll wait here while we get Alan back online here.
And I am back now as well.
Oh, good. Mitch is back. And so, Alan, are you back with us? Not quite yet. Mitch, let me ask you this. A customer wants a part. Does he get a prototype, or can he get a prototype before he goes into a production run?
Oh, absolutely. That's 99% of the time, that's the way it works. Is people start off with a prototype. They verify that that everything fits and looks good and fits their purpose, and then they move into the production run. So that's the way the cycle works.
Now, where do you see this going in terms of size? I know we attended a conference out in Chicago Fabtech, and they had a model of an F-35 that they'd made with a 3D printer. It was probably 8 feet long. Where do you see this going in terms of size with cloud DDM?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, as far as the size limits of the technology, there really isn't any. I mean, it's if you've got the time to wait for it and the money to pay for it, size really isn't an issue. I have seen machines that can print things as big as a blade for a windmill and basically do it on site.
Oh wow!
So I think there are really, really interesting. There's no size limitation. Well, as far as cloud TDM though, we're tending to focus on where the mass market manufacturing is, and so we want to continue to work on our rapid build envelopes for the sizes that match 80 to 90% of what the products are out in the market today. Because I think if you go off and build the capability to do really, really big parts, there's definitely a demand for that. I see it in a lot of panels for panels for airplanes, panels for skinning different machines, et cetera. So I see the needs for big parts for panels. That's probably a more of a niche business for mm-hmm. someone to focus on and be really good at, versus us trying to focus on being speed and the ability to produce in volume.
Mitch, how many machines do you have in the Louisville facility, and how many do you think you're going to add this year?
So we're currently at 100, and we have provisioned for 1,000.
Wow.
And, we've provisioned for 1,000, and I think we'll just keep adding those consistently as we. As demand continues to ramp up, we'll add another bank of machines, and as demand ramps, mm-hmm. we'll add another bank. And I alluded earlier that our intent is to spread this globally and sort of duplicate it in Europe and Asia and Latin America, and then have these facilities connected. And there's an analogy to what Amazon did with the Elastic Computing Cloud. What we're building effectively is the Elastic Manufacturing Cloud. With globally connected on-demand capability. And back to what Alan referenced earlier, we see a very interesting opportunity there to be a fulfiller and a provider for digital virtual on-demand inventory. So rather than physical inventory, if we can actually produce those parts and components on an on-demand basis around the world to help companies satisfy their spare parts, their replacement parts, their warranty obligations, versus having that physical inventory stored somewhere that they've got cash tied up in and they're paying for storage, and then it always happens to be in the wrong place. We think there's a really good opportunity for us to add a lot of value to the world, to the economy, to the manufacturing sector, by allowing people to reduce that $1.8 trillion in inventory, or whatever the number was, Alan. So I think that was it. Inventory, yeah, and then deploy that capital in more efficient ways.
Okay. Now, Alan, you and I were talking in kind of a preamble to the show on what's happening in the UPS stores. You have 3D printers in UPS stores. Is that correct?
We do. So today we have over 60 UPS stores around the country where we have 3D printers, and the vision, as Mitch just alluded to, is to make this part of a global network for on-demand printing. And today, people that need prototypes can go into to a UPS store with one of these printers and take care of what they need. In the future, we want to have that capability not just in the U.S., but around the world. And we want to be on the front edge of that, because the more people are spending digital instructions to print a product as opposed to manufacturing them and shipping a physical product in a brown truck. We want to be on the front end of that because we think it will be disruptive.
Yeah, well, that certainly would be. Now, is this, what kind of parts are you seeing people print today, and what do you think they'll be printing in the store in the future, Alan?
In the store, what we're seeing primarily are models and prototypes. What we're seeing in with Cloud VM is we are seeing prototypes, but we're also seeing a lot of production parts. And that's what we think this year and into next year is going to be the primary area of growth.
Okay, well, that certainly makes sense. I would expect to see the prototypes come out first, and I'm dying to get to tap in someplace to a 3D printer and be able to make my coffee mug with our logo on it so I can run out and see what it looks like. I haven't actually held a 3D printed part yet, I don't think, so I'm excited to see that. Anything happening in the consumer arena, Mitch? I know most of what you're doing is business to business. What's happening in the consumer side of things? Can the consumer get any 3D printed parts today, something they would recognize?
Well, they can. I mean, the consumer market for it it tends to be hobbyist and artisan. And if you look at, you know, websites like Etsy, where there's a lot of arts and crafts, you'll find things on there that are 3D printed. In many cases, they look kind of rough because they're coming off of low-end printers. I'll call them the educational grade printers, such as the MakerBot, et cetera. Those are really good for educational type stuff, but they're not so good for end use parts. I think on the consumer stuff, people are learning a lot. They're learning about 3D CAD files, 3D data. They're learning about what the design constraints are or are not, and it's a really good educational space. I think it's helping ignite some of the passion in younger people for making. And as you know, we have a shortage of talent or interest in this country for people
right.
are makers. So I see it helping to fuel that. I see some people doing some artsy stuff with the consumer things. There's a company called Shapeways that does a lot in that consumer space of printing. They're pretty cheap. They're pretty low quality. It's not run like a manufacturing operation where you would get, you know, material certificates and quality control. So, we see a lot of the consumer stuff happening at companies like Shapeways. If you don't need a date or anything like that, and that's a great company to go to for something like that. But so there definitely is some consumer demand, but mostly around the arts and educational.
Okay,
Mitch, are you? I was offline for a bit, lost some connection, and I missed part of the conversation. So forgive me if I'm repeating a question. I know that Boeing, in their most recent aircraft, has something like 300. Like 3,000. Different parts that are 3D printed. Is that an area that you're looking to get into or are into? Those kind of production numbers can be very lucrative contracts.
Yeah, so we're not doing anything for Boeing specifically, but we are doing stuff for some other aircraft companies. And that primarily tends to be parts that are made out of Ultem, that ULTEM. Ultem is a plastic that is very it's flame retardant, heat resistant, and it doesn't smoke. So it's the kind of a plastic you would want to have in an airplane.
Right.
And a lot of the parts that we see are for like ducting, for funneling, air conditioning or cabin pressure gauges, stuff like that. So there's normally Ultem, it's ducting, some panels. Things like that absolutely make sense. So we're not seeing any applications where, at least in our case, we're making any structural parts for the airplane, but some interior cosmetic parts and ducting is actually a great application.
Is there going to, do you foresee in the future where you or others will be able to produce titanium parts, for example, 6-4 to an AMS 4928 with certifications and so on? Is that something in the cards?
It is. Absolutely, it is. And so we can produce, you know, a titanium 6-4 today. But, you know, I think there's still some issues around the structural, there's concerns around the structural integrity of those parts, because they are built on a layer by layer basis, and they may very well be good, they meet the structural requirements, but I think there's still a little bit of skepticism, and so time has to catch up with that, and so do the machines. And by saying that, so we're seeing people start to build in cameras into machines now, so that every time the machine prints a layer of that titanium, the camera is taking a photograph or a video of that layer, and then it builds the next layer and it takes a photograph. So now we're able to actually look at the internal structure of the part as it builds, look for any voids or pockets or things where there was a bad spot in the material. And so I think, you know, the measures to do quality control on additive metal parts made out of, whether it's titanium, stainless, cobalt, chrome, or otherwise, are catching up. And so I think the parts are pretty darn good today. They may be good enough for some good structural applications, but the systems are coming along in order to be able to prove and verify that. And, you know, I, for one, want to know those systems are in place before I fly on an airplane that,
yeah,
such a part. So.
Well, let me show off my metallurgical expertise for a minute. And you're talking about the layering, whether it's plastic or titanium. When you're layering, the underneath layer, I presume that's still hot, and the new layer is also hot. Is there any grain structure or grain sizes that are being formed like in a wrought product or a forged product?
There is, you know, and so we're pretty darn, and this is stuff where software is still evolving as well, because depending on how you make that layer, you know, in what pattern, if you do it 45 degrees or 30 degrees or in some swirly pattern compared to the prior layer, and yes, they're hot. Yes, they're built in an oven, which helps keep the material at a certain temperature that helps the layers bond better. So there's a lot of science around the parameters of making the parts. And, what pattern you make the layers, at what temperature the laser is, at the temperature of the oven the part's being made in. So there is grain direction, grain patterns, interlocking of layers. All those sorts of things are coming into play, and metals that's much more immature in metals than it is. Plastics is very mature at this point. Metals is still quite immature.
I just want to ask because UPS is a large company worldwide. Are you working with any of the universities, colleges, technical schools on some of the observations you're doing in new technology?
Yes, we are. As a matter of fact, so we work with the major universities on a number of different levels. Mainly, it's with the supply chain areas and trying to keep on pace with the new things coming to market. From a technology perspective, around 3D printing. Our test lab is in Louisville, Kentucky, with Cloud EDM, and that's how we're learning. UPS is, we're not manufacturers, and so the way that we're learning is by partnering and investing in a company like Cloud EDM that does have that expertise. So that's really where we're focused right now, but. In other areas, absolutely, we're tapping into universities.
Well, that's great to hear, because that's certainly one of the areas that we've identified in a number of shows where we've talked about what is known as the skills gap, how we're going to solve that problem, and certainly reaching into the universities and colleges will be very helpful. Lou?
Yeah, we've had actually quite a few shows on the skill gaps and the 3 million shortages in manufacturing and so on. That being said, the two of you have a great partnership story in that you're both unrelated to each other. And we're curious about what the future plan is, if you're able to speak of that. Are you going to be a Google-like empire in the 3D printing because you got the first jump? Are there others behind you that are coming up behind you? Certainly, UPS has very deep pockets and can really make a major statement in the industry. So that's kind of a multifaceted question. So start off anywhere you like.
Yeah, there's a lot of meat to that question.
That is. There is. So I'll start out if you don't mind. There, I'll just say,
sure.
For me, you know, being one of the things I've learned throughout my career and entrepreneurial career is if you add value to your customers and you help them solve their needs, good things happen. So are there companies coming behind us? Probably. But I also found that it doesn't do any good to look in the rearview mirror. It's better to look, you know, to just look ahead, very close with your customers, love your customers, and listen to their needs, solve their needs. And then the market sort of takes you in the right direction. They either value what you're providing or they don't. And if they don't, then you have to shift gears. So what the future holds for us, I think, is sort of in the hands of you know, it's in our hand, it's how well we read the customer's needs and we solve them, and ultimately the customers will determine our future.
Yeah, we have a little noise in the background. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I what I would add to that is, you know, we really don't know where this is going to end up. And so what we're focused on right now and who we think is going to be the winner are the people that learn the quickest and adapt. Because we honestly don't know how quickly this evolution is going to take hold. But as Mitch said, we not only want to be quick learners, but we want to be really focused on what's adding value and what's not. Because when we look at disruptions aren't disruptions because they're new. Disruptions are a disruption because it helps someone do what they needed to do before in a better or less expensive way. And so that's what we're really focused on. We think that if we can, you know, continue to add value, we're going to unlock that equation that leads to growth. Today we're in the very, very early stages of it, and every day what we're learning is all the things we still need to learn.
Yeah, and you know, if I could chime in, I'll say, well, one of the real values to having a partner like UPS is one, we share a common value that we both believe if you do what's the right thing for the customer, then good things happen to the business, and you know, the customer is the most important thing in any business. And so, you know, I've had businesses where I've partnered with venture capitalists and private equity, and it's a very different dynamic versus when you partner with someone like UPS that has a very strategic view. The view of, let's figure this out. Let's listen to customers. Let's zig and zag, and let's figure out what the customers need and how to solve their challenges and make them more successful, which will in turn lift us. And you often don't get that when you partner with a financial institution that's really just looking at how fast can they drive numbers and have an exit and return money to their shareholders. UPS, of course, like any good investor, they're very financially astute, and they want to make financially sound investments for their investors and shareholders, but they're also very strategic in their view and patient as you listen to customers and do things in a very thoughtful way and not in a way to how can you make the quickest buck the fastest. And you know, so that's one of my things that I really like about being partnered up with UPS.
That being the long answer to my longer question, how many machines are you going to install this year?
Yeah, I think we don't know, actually. And I say that's the answer. We don't know. We're going to let the, you know, we definitely will be installing machines, but it really, I think, depends on how well we, you know, how well we uncover and tap into the needs of our customers and what that demand is. Like any prudent business, we want to grow, but we don't want to grow for the sake of growing. We want to grow for the right opportunities that add the right value. And if those growth opportunities and applications don't present themselves, then I think we have to have the discipline to be patient as the technology and the applications continue to evolve.
I think that's an excellent answer. And as long as the manufacturing sector opens up and accepts new technology, they'll be more open to 3D printing as a viable next step in their product mix.
Mm-hmm. One thing I learned, in building MFG.com was no matter, sometimes companies will raise a lot of money and they'll use that money to try to prejudice an adoption curve. And I think I've learned in my career that markets are going to adopt at a certain rate. Now, you can prejudice that curve a little bit through awareness and education and evangelism and things like that, but not significantly. And so you have to be very thoughtful to grow in lockstep with the rate that the market wants to adopt versus if you try to throw a lot of money and prejudice the curve substantially, you'll just wind up wasting a lot of money.
Mitch, what do you think is, 20 years down the road, capable of being produced by a digital printer?
Wow. I think most anything. I think you're going to see entire products produced. I mean, today we can produce mechanical assemblies in one print, so you don't even have to assemble products. But I think you're going to see things printed with more fidelity, with more finishing details, great color, great resolution. And you're going to see embedded electronics. And that'll probably be some pick-and-place stuff where you'll have like a little robotic arm that maybe places a circuit board or something inside of a component just being printed. I think mm-hmm. you'll see the growth of multi-material printers where you'll print something in plastic and maybe have a nylon or a rubber, such as today in the molding world, we would refer to that as over-molding, right? So I think you'll see electronics embedded, you'll see multi-materials, you'll see better surface finishes, high fidelity. And ultimately, I think that leads to end-use products coming straight off the printer and going into a box somewhere in the world on an on-demand basis near the customer demand. And you'll see those being flavored to the cultural taste of geography wherever they're being consumed.
Astonishing. And I agree with everything you said. It's exactly where I think it's going to go. Alan, UPS, what do they see coming out of this, 10, 20 years hence?
Yeah, we have a similar vision. And, when you think about products being produced closer to the point of consumption, you're talking about significant savings in cost, significant reductions in waste, significant improvements to the environment, and it is going to change supply chains, because as this begins to take hold again, you're not going to need to have a UPS jet necessarily fly a part from Louisville to Shanghai. You'll send it you'll send digital instructions and print it in Shanghai. And so so we see this as a potential threat, but we also see it as an opportunity, because as we weave this into the physical supply chain that we have around the world today, we can begin to add value today. And, you know, maybe one day the Jetsons will come true and we'll be beaming things everywhere. And but that's a long ways down the road. In the meantime, there's a lot of value to be added by participating in this development, and that's kind of where we are today.
Yeah, I think that is exactly where it is headed. It'll be interesting to see if that's where we end up. Mitch, I'd like you to share with our audience the websites for the two companies that you're working in and kind of a quick definition of each, if you would, please.
Absolutely. So Cloud DDM, and that's Cloud and then DDM. And the DDM is Direct Digital Manufacturing, in case anyone's wondering. So clouddDDM.com, and that is where we're doing additive manufacturing of metal and plastic with speed and scale. So we can get parts delivered you know, as early as the next morning. And then the other website is Zyci.com, and that's Z-Y-C-I, Zebra Yankee Charlie India.com. And that is CNC machining, traditional subtractive manufacturing, also done with a lot of speed. We're focused on very quick turnarounds of complex parts, and as well as simple parts. And a lot of times we're working direct from the customer's 3D model, and across a wide variety of industries, from aerospace, automotive, and medical devices are primary.
Alan, UPS, I'm assuming, is just UPS.com, and you're a logistics company, but it's so much more than that. Can you give our listeners kind of the elevator pitch on UPS?
Absolutely. So everyone is familiar with the brown trucks. That we have a global small package business, and hopefully over the holidays you had some of those trucks visiting your home. And that is our core business. We also have a supply chain division, which is the area that I'm in. And we have ocean and air freight forwarding. We have a ground freight unit. And then we run distribution and service parts network for companies around the globe, every continent, and primarily in healthcare, high tech, automotive and industrial and retail industries. So if you had a flu shot this year, that vaccine likely came through a UPS healthcare distribution center. So some areas where you might not have thought of UPS in the past, but we're a part of extended supply chains for many companies.
Well, Alan, we want to thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate your insights today.
Oh, you bet. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And Mitch, thank you for joining us with Cloud DDM and 3D printing. Fascinating what you're doing in conjunction with UPS. We appreciate you being with us today as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm passionate about manufacturing. Always happy to talk about it.
Thank you very much, and we'll reach back to these two gentlemen in the future and see what's happening with 3D printing and also what UPS is up to, because they're always up to some very fascinating things, as well as what Mitch is doing and rolling out Cloud DDM and Zyci in the CNC world. We appreciate you listening today to Manufacturing Talk Radio. Please tune in and listen to us next week for our show, and we will wrap it up for today and look forward to you listening again next week at mfgtalkradio.com.
Thanks for joining us on Manufacturing Talk Radio. You can hear our next broadcast each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at mfgtalkradio.com.